The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Key catalysts this week were Fed Chair Powell's semi-annual congressional testimony on Tuesday and Wednesday that supported stocks. He said clearly that the economy is a long way from reaching full employment and an average inflationary goal of 2%. On Wednesday, he doubled down and told Congress that it could take 3 or more years for the economy to reach the Fed's inflationary goal.
We see this as a pullback in an uptrend, and accordingly, a pullback that should be bought.
Demand is so high in all of my 40 years of following this market rather closely, I have never seen a premium on a 1,000-ounce bar at the level we have now.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan, the host of our weekday FS Insider podcast. On today's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour, Ryan Poplava, CEO of Financial Sense Wealth Management, is going to give us a wrap-up of the things that move the market this week. After that, Jim Poplava is going to interview Ari Wald from Oppenheimer to get his technical outlook on the market and why they think that this is a dip that should be bought. After that, we have a special roundtable where Jim, Dave Morgan, and Ronan Manley from Bullion Star discuss how silver premiums for physical metal are much higher than what we're seeing in the paper market. So they talk about the silver squeeze and what they think this means for the silver market in the weeks and months ahead.
So to set the stage for this week, let's remember the key catalyst last week. I mentioned we started seeing some rate sensitivity in stocks for the first time, meaning when interest rates rose, stocks indices started to pull back, especially in growth-sensitive areas in the NASDAQ. And we saw that especially February 17th, when interest rates rose on economic news from a surge in retail sales, in addition to the record rise in the producer price index for January. Now, let's step into this week. The key catalysts this week were Fed Chair Powell's semi-annual congressional testimony on Tuesday and Wednesday that supported risk sentiment in stocks. And that catalyst had to compete with a surge in interest rates caused by positive economic news and a weak Treasury auction on Thursday. So before Powell spoke on Tuesday, the S&P 500 had 5 negative consecutive daily closes and was already down 1.8% on the day, within 10 points of its 50-day moving average. And the rate-sensitive NASDAQ was down at 1.35% on the day. So Powell's prepared remarks and testimony came to the rescue, affirming a dovish monetary policy stance for some time to come. He said clearly that the economy is a long way from reaching full employment and an average inflationary goal of 2%, their dual mandate. On Wednesday, he doubled down and told Congress that it could take 3 or more years for the economy to reach the Fed's inflationary goal. So basically, in the face of rising long-term yields, which we're seeing right now, rising energy prices, rising base metal prices, the Fed will hold short-term interest rates firmly down. So we continue to see that 2-year versus 10-year yield spread widen. Combined with some technical support levels near that 50-day moving average, like I mentioned, Powell's comments were able to support risk sentiment in supporting stocks. Before getting into the weeds here on interest rates, the second part of this week and the second major catalyst to really talk about, the 10-year Treasury started the month of February at 1.09%. Now, Thursday, the 10-year Treasury yield hit a high intraday of 1.61% on a volatile day of trading before closing on Friday at 1.4%. So overall, for the month of February, Treasury yield is up 31 basis points and the month isn't over. And so far, we can't tell if the trend is over in that rise in interest rates. So what investors have to sort out right now is this. Will the expansive budget policy plan this year and a dovish monetary policy embolden the bond vigilantes to drive rates higher to the point of breaking the stock market advance? The rise in stocks has been predicated on long-term interest rates remaining low and the economy recovery continuing. The concern as of late is whether that $1.9 trillion stimulus is too much, or even more so if there's another infrastructure bill coming down the pipe later this year. Chris Poplava and I spoke about this several weeks ago where we looked at the amount of debt the U.S. will have to refinance this year to the tune of $7.7 trillion of debt. You know, I laugh somewhat because an article I read on Bloomberg back in January, it was titled, "A $13 trillion Debt Bill Comes Due for Big Economies." About this, said the median of economists surveyed were projecting the 10-year yield of hitting 1.24% by the end of the year. We beat it in a month. But it's really no joke. $62 billion, 7-year notes for the U.S. Treasury went for auction in the afternoon on Thursday, but the showing was terrible. A bid-to-cover ratio of basically 2. And what that means is for every $2 bid for these Treasuries securities, it was for $1 worth of Treasuries. The average typically over the past 10 years was a rate of 2.4. So 2 was a poor showing. So despite Powell's efforts to calm inflationary fears, bond investors weren't buying it, literally. Previous auctions this week of $60 billion worth of 2-year Treasuries, $61 billion worth of 5-year notes were all also below average demand, according to Reuters. I'll step off the soapbox here, but it's interesting to see how the story has changed in mainstream media. I mean, just yesterday there was a USA Today article. The title was, "With the economy healing, is Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package too much?" And that leads me into the final part of the wrap-up. The strong economic news continues to roll in this week. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index was up 10% in December. Consumer Confidence Index rose to 91.3 in February, with current conditions improving for the first time in 4 months. New home sales were up 4.3% in January, and especially in the South, where year over year, there's been a 40% increase in home sales. Initial claims dropped a ton on Thursday for the announced on Thursday for the week ending February 20th by 111,000, dropping to levels we haven't seen since November. Durable goods orders for January surged 3.4%, and finally, personal income soared 10% in January, showing a personal savings rate of 20.5% as a percentage of disposable personal income. And that's before another wave of stimulus comes down the road. That's it for the major stories this week. And Catalysts, on to you, Jim, and our technician this week, Ari Wald.
Peter Zeihan said on FS Insider this week that the winterization of the Texas power grid will actually lead to a further acceleration in the use of renewable energy, both wind and solar. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners this week on FS Insider.
We've got three things that are going on independently that are creating the perfect storm for an explosion of wind power, in particular in Texas. The first is that we have wind turbines that are coming online that are pushing 600 feet tall from the base. And as wind turbines get bigger, the amount of power that they generate increases exponentially compared to their cost of installation, because they're able to tap stronger and more reliable wind currents. Second, wind power is now becoming cost-effective in Texas without the subsidy structure at all. So it's just a question of reliability and volume, and that has nothing to do with the political situation. Texas utilities are now looking at wind power as a reliable source of power. And that's going to be doubled down because of the third factor, in that winterizing a wind turbine requires one of two things: heating elements in the blades, or a local drone port that can carry a de-icing capacity and spray down the blades. Now, neither of those are free, but neither of those are overly expensive. And since we now have wind towers that are generating like 3 megawatts each, you don't have to do it all that many places. Compare that to the cost of winterizing a century of legacy fossil fuel infrastructure across the state.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market has been hitting one record after another with occasional hiccups. We're doing this interview on a Thursday where we're getting a hiccup. Is this something serious or just another opportunity as markets head higher? Joining me on the phone is Ari Wald from Oppenheimer. And Ari, let's begin with what's going on Thursday. We've got a spike up in yields and we've got the markets pull out. So your take on this technically.
Yeah, our take with the S&P 500 down about 3.5% from an all-time high reached earlier in February. We see this as a pullback in an uptrend, and accordingly, a pullback that should be bought. I think what's notable to us is that the index is even still above its 50-day average. It's corrected right at that's been a near-term support level. So the beauty of these trends and the charts to keep things in perspective. It doesn't feel good today with the market down, but a look at the chart would suggest that weakness is a function of really just a strong run-up that we saw into February. And as the market's consolidating some of those gains, our anticipation would be that the longer-term trend does prevail, and we should see some higher prices again over the coming weeks.
Now, in some of your key points about the market, this is the second year of a bull market where the average advance is somewhere around 11%. You see these moves typically last 2.5 years. So that would tell me, Ari, 2021 should be another good year for stock investors.
That's our assumption, and that's the roadmap that we're following, that March 2020 reset the equity cycle where we had indiscriminate market selling. All the indicators that we watched reset and the typical signs of a bear market low were reached. And now subsequent action has been consistent with a new bull market. So we are following a roadmap that we're now coming up into the 1 year anniversary, a month away still, of that bear market low and new bull market. And following that roadmap, you hit it on the head that they typically last about 2.5 years. So barring any changes in our indicators, we're assuming that it can continue through 2021. And the important point is that our checks are still there. That, again, thinking in terms of a pullback and an uptrend, important to note that in February, most major market averages, what we would say, confirmed the S&P's advance. Small caps made a new high. Overseas equities made a new high. Our breadth indicators made a new high. There was really no stress in credit spreads either. And so for all those reasons, no divergences to point to that would suggest something is amiss. And accordingly, I think our roadmap is intact and we're still following it.
So when you're taking a look at this kind of market, last year it was a story of the tech stocks, in particular the FANG stocks that drove a lot of what I call the COVID stocks. You're seeing a broadening global advance.
It's not just tech anymore. It's tech and it's tech and the right areas too, where you have emerging markets breaking out through resistance dating back to the year 2007. The European indexes breaking out or attempting to break out through resistance levels dating back to the year 2000. Even here in the U.S., the value areas finally starting to work. One key point we've been stressing is that as we talked about this dispersion in the market, we've acknowledged it. We agree that it's been very one-sided towards tech and the high growth names. But if you really kind of look at what has been causing it, it was less so the strength in tech and just more so how weak the balance of the market was. It was how the anomaly in the extremes was really driven by how weak value was. So the fact that now that area of the market's working after what was a pretty difficult two-year stretch, a two-year bear market for a lot of those deep cyclical areas, just starting to break out to the upside, that's the type of participation you want to see. that's the type of leadership you want to see, and why we think this advance has legs to it.
The other thing we're starting to see, and maybe this is a reflection of a recovering economy, you're starting to see some areas like industrials, materials, and the financials with a steepening yield curve start to break out. Let's talk about that. And then also what's happening with some areas that have been breaking down. You're seeing consumer staples. You're seeing it also in things like discretionary. So address that, if you would. Is it just a value rotation, or is it the fact that people think that this market is going to be pretty strong this year with strong economic growth?
You know, really for us, we would side with the latter, that it's about the market pricing in an economic recovery and better economic growth. And with that, we're, the key theme for us has been less so growth versus value, more so really just a pure play on risk and beta. And it's been high beta stocks, which includes both financials, capital market areas, within industrials, capital goods, and technology too. People forget technology. Semiconductors are a beta area. They typically outperform in a rising market environment. And on the flip side, that outperformance has come at the expense of these low volatility, high dividend paying defensive sectors. Consumer staples, REITs, utilities have lagged the most, you know, really through the course of this recovery. I think, in fact, with tech here, it gets lumped into the safety trade, and it has indeed sold off of late as there's been a rise in interest rates. But we still think technology is still going to produce some of the steadier returns over the long term. And so for these reasons, as we think about portfolio diversification, we think you want to own both your high beta cyclicals and your high earnings growers. That's the right balance. And it's really the defensive areas that I think you want to stay away from that are most at risk to underperform with this market backdrop.
So when you see this kind of rotation as we're seeing right now, and you see the market broadening out, any other areas that stand out to you?
To rattle off just some top industries, and it's really given how, as we talk about broadening participation, there's a broadening list of areas to talk about. So, of course, there's with capital markets, there's housing, there's it's still internet's working, machinery, metals, retail, semiconductor, software. And transports. I think transports is an interesting area. That was our most recent upgrade. We upgraded the transportation industry 2 weeks ago. Again, another area of the market just starting to see emerging relative strength. We had been waiting for that upgrade to the point where we were able to finally get behind airlines. That had been the missing piece of the puzzle there. And airlines, part of the reopening trade, whether it's airlines, cruise lines, and those previously beaten up areas, they all had a big breakout in the fourth quarter. Right around November, they finally broke out. That's when you saw participation expand. Since then, they had consolidated. We upgraded them. Now you're seeing them turn higher again. Again, I think that's good action in the market. And again, a reason why we think that we're still more early to mid-cycle in this advance.
So let's talk about another area of the market. In fact, the day that you and I are talking, we're seeing a spike in Treasury yields. Speak to that. How high does this go, and could that spell trouble for the market in the future?
For us, you have to think about interest rates both in terms of the level and the direction. While many think the level, a high level of interest rates is a concern for the market, typically that directionally getting to high level levels of interest rates, it tends to be a good thing. Low and rising is good. High and falling is bad. Now, it's been the pace of rates more recently that has been attributed to some of this volatility in the equity market. Equities do like more intermarket stability, and anytime you see kind of one-sided moves, whether it's in the fixed income or currency or commodity markets, it can register some volatility, and we're seeing that. So speaking in terms of the level of interest rates, I think what's notable is that we're back above the levels where the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield really first started to cascade lower during its COVID collapse 1 year ago exactly, right around 1.4%. So this places the 10-year back into its 2019 range between about 1.5% and 2%. The issue is that rates are extremely overbought here. The 10-year U.S. Treasury yield is currently 70 basis points above its 200-day average. That's been the extreme in rates over the prior decade. So I think some consolidation is in order, and that's going to carry implications for the swings in risk, that rates really have been the key driver of these market rotations. It's been risk up, good for beta, bad for the defensive areas. And conversely, you flip that the other way. If you see rates start to move lower, that's when we've seen the more defensive action in the market. We ran some numbers just in terms of the implications for high growth companies. Of course, fundamentally speaking, the high rates tend to be a concern for high growth companies, just given that it tends to put pressure on the terminal value as we think about cash flows and how you value these companies. That really hasn't been the case. I know they're under pressure recently, but we recall the period from 2016 to 2018 where interest rates nearly doubled from 1.5% to 3%. And a lot of those high growth areas, technology, software actually outperformed. And we did a study and showed that the growth benchmarks, the forward returns really don't turn below average until the 10-year rate gets closer to 4%. And of course, we're well below there. So I think we're still at a point where, yes, rates are rising here, but I don't think it should be a headwind for neither growth stocks nor the equity market as a whole.
Let's move on next to commodities. Last year, just about every single commodity got hit with the downturn in the economy and lockdowns. Energy, which has been on a negative cycle for almost a decade, now we're starting to see the kind of what I call the green commodities start to do well, copper, nickel, lead, things that are important for electric EVs and the green economy. And then when you take a look at what's going on in commodities, gold and silver seem to be struggling while oil is taking off. So what's your take on commodities here?
It's still generally a mixed bag, but Jim, I think we could be at an important turning point for commodities, broadly speaking, that this weakness in the dollar that we've seen due to the inverse correlation has helped commodities rally. And in turn, the commodity indexes that we tracked have broken through very important resistance levels and possibly have reversed what had been a 10-year downtrend going into last year's low point. Now, for us, it has been the industrial metal that is most compelling in our work, which would be the copper play, which did breakthrough major five-year base. So I think it's about picking your spots. Industrial metals for us look best in terms of energy prices. Crude oil's trading higher, but hasn't had the same breakout. Gold's more that safe haven play. So maybe oil and gold continue to just swing around based on the direction of risk off. But there could be something brewing in commodity land, and we're participating through the metals.
So given the fact on the day you and I are speaking, we're having a sell-off in the market, if you were to put money to work, and let's say this, we correct here for a little bit, where would you go specifically? Would you stick with the cyclicals and the recovery?
We like a mix of both the cyclicals and recovery. And the high earnings technology names as well. So we're at this weird juncture where the cyclicals are working, but they're no longer tactical. They've gotten somewhat overbought. And the tech stuff isn't working. It doesn't feel right to buy them here, but they're the tactical play. They're less extended. And I think there's some contrarian potential for them to pop back. And as they say, rotations are the hallmark of a healthy bull market, that they could actually help lead the next move higher. So for us, it's just owning them both. I think portfolio diversification is important here to help reduce some of that volatility in a portfolio. And so it's about buying transports, buying financials, and sticking with technology and the tech names for the long run.
Ari, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Oppenheimer, how could they do so?
Well, they could follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wolf.
All right, Ari, thanks so much for coming on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
Cyclically important commodities are signaling an economic boom. So says Nick Reese from Merck Research, who spoke with us on FS Insider this week about the current market action and the areas he likes best. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
The CRB Raw Industrial Commodities Index is comprised of a lot of things that aren't traded that actively in futures markets. It's burlap, copper scrap, cotton, hides, lead scrap, tallow, tin, zinc. So it's these things that aren't really, the price is really going to be indicative of underlying fundamental supply and demand. And that index has really been shooting higher since the middle of last year. And that's a strong indicator for, I would say, for a boom in the real economy.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, one investment that has done well recently has been the precious metals market, gold and silver, and even some of the metals stock. But there's a disparity in the markets today. Just go out and try to find bullion. And if you can get it, what are you going to pay for it in the way of a premium? In contrast to the paper market. So today's discussion, we're going to take a look at paper and physical and why you want to own physical. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan. He's editor of the Morgan Report. And Ronan Manley. He's a precious metals analyst with Bullion Star in Singapore. Dave, I'm going to direct this question to you as we begin. And that is, the futures market sometimes is often in different directions from what's going in the bullion market. And that's the case today. I mean, if you're able to get precious metals, I don't care if you're buying Eagles, Maple Leafs, Krugerrands, they're in short supply if you can get them. And the premiums have never been this large, at least in terms of the last decade or so. So what's going on, and how would you explain the difference between what's going on in the physical market and then what's going on in the bullion market?
Well, Jim, this is David Morgan. As you stated, there really are two different markets. I mean, the COMEX, the CME-run paper market, is a derivative market, basically. Yes, there are warehouses or vaults that hold physical silver, but the primary purpose of that market is a derivative of the physical silver market. So when you get into the retail market, which is where a lot of investors put their money, with bars, coins, government rounds, whatever, and there's congestion in the market, meaning the demand is so high for that retail product that cannot be met, the premiums soar. Now, we saw this in the 2008 financial crisis, and I wrote an article about the arbitrage opportunity, and I was going contra to some of the silver bugs, saying that I thought that you would see the premiums fall back and come more normalized to what the silver or the derivatives market was producing as a price. And actually, that's what happened. We've been seeing congestion in the market almost its entire year. And to the best of my knowledge, the premiums on retail products have held up above average the whole time. They started to subside a few months ago. And then once this Wall Street Bets Reddit subgroup Wall Street Silver came on board, the premiums have soared and stayed there. The one final statement I want to make is that in all of my 40 years of following this market rather closely, I have never seen a premium on a 1,000-ounce bar at the level we have now. Few of the primary dealers that I know from the A-marks on down are looking at like 80 cents to $1, $1.20 in that range, Jim, to take delivery of commercial bar silver. So I'll just leave it at that. There's a lot of demand, and there's not apparently enough supply to meet that demand at the current time.
The premiums that you're seeing in the physical market and basically the paper market, which has gone nowhere here probably for the last 3 or 4 months. Usually, if you think about economics, the way it works, if you have a lot more demand for something than there is supply, the price would go up. Why is it going up in the bullion market and it's not going up in the paper market, either one of you?
I'll take it, and Ronan can add on to it. Again, it's a derivatives market. And, you know, as much as there's a lot of questions surrounding the derivatives market, for the most part, the commercial bar market has had enough supply from whatever the source, from a refinery direct or a smelter direct, not necessarily coming off the COMEX, to meet the true physical demand. But right now, that's not taking place. But we've got to look at it a bit deeper, Jim. And that means that the 1,000-ounce bar that's going to become, let's say, a government-minted coin has got to be shipped to, let's say, the Sunshine Refinery. Then it's melted down, then it's poured and it's extruded, then it's punched, and then there's a die made, and you punch in to the blank the Silver Eagle. So that whole process adds like $2 or $3 to the price. Obviously, you had to transport it, labor involved, machinery involved, everything involved. So the market for silver is the commercial bar market. The retail market has to do with coins and everything else and has a premium built in just to the process. But where the dislocation comes in is where you get these huge wide spreads and they move into the physical market. As I just mentioned, commercial bars having a premium. To me, that speaks that something's going on in this market that we haven't seen in my lifetime. And I just like to defer to Ronan, if I might, to maybe poke holes in what I said or elaborate on it.
Yeah, I agree with what David is saying. What we're seeing, we need to make a differentiation between the retail market and the wholesale market. From a physical retail point of view, there always will be premiums on bars and coins above the spot price because that reflects fabrication costs, transport, marketing, distribution. But then if you think about up from the retail side to the wholesalers, to the refiners and mints, when retailers buy physical bullion, coins and bars, they also have to pay above the spot price because that reflects refining, fabrication, et cetera. And we've seen, we are actually lucky in a way because being based in Singapore, we have good relationships with different distributors and refineries in Asia. And for example, we take a lot of silver from Heraeus in Hong Kong. And Heraeus are quoting much higher premiums between them and us than they would usually do so, 2-3 times higher for silver. And that's because they also, where they source their metal, either from back along the supply chain or from the interbank market, they're seeing that banks are quoting them premiums 2-3 times higher than normal. So that's something that we didn't see back in March 2020, April and May 2020, when there was a dislocation between COMEX and London in the gold market, which then spread into silver. There were normal premiums on the wholesale silver market back then. But now the premiums in the wholesale market have doubled and nearly tripled, which, again, to reiterate what David was saying, that has never happened before. So it suggests that the silver squeeze, the demand for silver in the from the whole retail market backwards, all the way up the chain, has started reflecting in higher premiums. But getting on quickly to the paper markets, and Jim, why you mentioned about the the divergence in price between the spot silver price that's derived in COMEX and London LBMA versus the retail market. We've done a lot of articles and research over the years on this very issue. The fact that the paper markets drive the price discovery and not the physical markets. So a lot of academics have heard with this as well, that COMEX trading volumes and LBMA unallocated trading volumes in London literally dictate the price of spot. So no matter what is going on in the physical markets, that doesn't really show up readily until maybe now going forward. So if you think about it, the unit of trading in London that the LBMA banks trade amongst themselves is unallocated silver. It's literally silver credit that they create out of thin air, and it's not really backed by physical. And then in COMEX, you've got silver futures, which are a derivative. So overall, everything that dictates the price is a derivative. And if it's in unlimited supply, then they can trade these units, and it has no bearing on what's going on in the physical market.
So do you ever see when there is a disparity, as we're seeing today, where you're paying these large premiums in the physical market, where basically in the paper market, you're not seeing that? What about, does it ever get to a point where it corrects and it balances out?
Jim, I'd like to go ahead and quote Kyle Bass on that. He sent out this tweet on the 10th of February, 2021, and quote, "If more than 5% of the contract holders of the front month silver take delivery, it will cause significant problems for the exchange. It's always been this way. The Hunt family figured this out in 1980. If the subredditors knew what was said to them in a backroom meeting, ... end quote. So it works until it doesn't work. We've talked about it in the past with you, Jim, on Financial Sense, that there's two markets and that the physical at some point could and possibly would take over the derivative market. And my main thesis is that this doesn't happen very often. It only happens if you look at the big picture, I call it, which is the failure of fiat currencies and a breakdown in trust and confidence in the entire system. And I think that's what is basically driving this, whether people know it consciously or subconsciously.
Well, you know, it's amazing because I've talked to a bullion dealer who I used to deal with. She deals mainly with hedge funds. And she said going back to March of last year, she's just had difficulty obtaining product. And you wouldn't notice that if you were looking at some of the prices that you've seen in the, let's say, paper market. So this is something that many people may not realize. In many ways, the paper markets operate almost like a fractional reserve system. And let me explain what I'm getting to here. If you deposit money in a bank, let's say I put $100 into a bank. Well, that bank is not going to sit on that money. They're going to loan out 90 cents. They'll keep 10 cents in reserves for cash. So all the money you put in a bank doesn't have all that money in cash on deposit. Likewise, it was explained to me once that in the futures market, you may have paper contracts that far exceed what they have in inventory, because in a way it operates almost like on a fractional system. Any one of you want to take that up? And also, number two, let's say, as Kyle Bass was talking about, it would overwhelm the market if 5% of people took delivery. But there's a little clause in the futures market that says, hey, if you have a silver contract and we don't have the silver to deliver, we could just settle in cash. Either one of you want to pick up on that?
I'll quickly interject. We did a whole chapter in the Silver Manifesto about fractional reserve bullion banking, but I'd like to hear what Roland has to add.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at both markets, London and COMEX, from the point of view of the fractional reserve market, because they are both examples of fractional reserve silver markets. In London, you've got the LBMA every month comes out with statistics saying they have such amount in their vaults. Currently, they say there's 33,600 tons in all of their vaults, which are literally the HSBC vault, JP Morgan, ICBC Standard Bank, and some of the security carriers, you'd call them, Brinks, Malkomid, and Lomas. And altogether, so there's 33,600 tons. So the LBMA would have you believe, and their bullion bank members, that that's a lot of silver. There's plenty, plentiful supply of silver to go around. But what you have to realize is that nearly all of that silver is already held by exchange-traded funds, which hold their silver in London. The biggest one of those is the iShares Silver Trust, SLB, which has about 19, 20,000 tons. But there's about 13, 14 other ETFs, which in total hold another 7,500 tons. So overall, these 14 ETFs, and they're run by providers like Aberdeen Standard, WisdomTree, Invesco, Deutsche Bank, EWS. So all of these in total have around 27, 28,000 tons of silver. Of that, 33,600 tons that's in London. So that doesn't really leave very much for anyone else after you take into account what the ETFs hold. So looking at the fractional reserve nature then of the trading in the silver market in London, if you take away all the silver that's in the ETFs, there's only around 6,000-7,000 tons, excluding the ETFs, which could be used to back up unallocated position trading in London. So if big institutions who have unallocated silver positions suddenly want to convert 500 tons, 1,000 tons, there's not very many times that they can do that. And we have to also remember that with this silver squeeze, a lot of traders on the Wall Street Silver, Wall Street Bets crowd, they're buying SLV, or they were buying SLV until they started switching to PSLV. But the point is that back in late January, early February, over 3 days, the 29th of January and the, I think it was the 2nd and 3rd of February, literally 3,500 tons was added to just SLV. And if that happened another one or two times, there wouldn't be any silver in London to back any of that. And then if you turn your attention to COMEX, so the COMEX inventories right now, they say there's about 12,300 tons. Two-thirds of that, 8,000 tons, is eligible, and the rest, 4,200, is registered. Registered means that there's a warrant attached, and that has been involved in COMEX silver contract trading. The other 8,000 tons eligible doesn't necessarily have anything to do with COMEX trading. The COMEX rulebook says that all the approved vaults in New York and the CNT and Delaware vaults have to report their eligible holdings of silver, which means any silver that's a 1,000-ounce bar and could be used for trading, but it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with trading. So straight away, as David mentioned, we're nearly at the end of February, and the first notice date for the March silver contract is coming up. I think it's tomorrow night or Friday morning. And if there was, for example, 20,000 contracts standing for delivery, or even 15,000, that's nearly like between 3,000 and 2,500 tons. And that could pretty quickly eat into the registered total of 4,000. So the margins are quite slim. And that kind of feeds into what you were mentioning about Kyle Bass. I'm not really too well up on the actual force majeure clause. So maybe David could talk about that.
Well, I can add on that, you know, it's been a while since I've read the entire contract. Most people that sign up for a futures contract never bother. But the bottom line is they can settle in cash. And, you know, I'll just leave it at that.
I want to focus here on silver just for a moment, because it's a monetary metal. It's an industrial metal. I mean, Dave, when you first introduced me to silver back in the 00 decade early on, a lot of silver was used in photography. Of course, we've gone a long ways now with digital photography and our cell phones. And a lot of silver was taken from scrap. It was recycled. Contrast that today, where you have, let's say, silver being used in solar panels with the green economy. You have it used in electronics. But Dave, I just don't see the recycling in electronics. Are you going to really get that much silver out of a cell phone?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, right now, the biggest recycling year that I can recall from memory was, I think, 1999. It was over 200 million ounces, and almost all of that was photographic waste. The current level, depending on which study you look at, somewhere around the 170 million, and it's claimed that most of that is electronic waste. What I do know is that as the industrial demand continues, especially with the quote-unquote green revolution, you're going to see less and less available. Yes, there'll always be recycled silver, people that will smelt coins, actually, but jewelry, silverware, other items, and electronic waste. I think there is an opportunity, actually, in the e-waste sector. I won't address it here, Jim, but it's not back up to the level it was during the photographic era.
So when you take a look at the use of precious metals, and they've always been a store of value throughout human history, I wonder if you'd both like to comment now on the competition coming in from cryptocurrencies. You've got, you know, some pretty big hitters out there like Elon Musk that talked about putting quite a bit into Bitcoin. What has that done to the precious metals market? I know a lot of the millennials and a lot of the Robinhood traders are into the cryptocurrencies, but what impact has that had on precious metals?
David Morgan, I'll take a stab at that. It's opinion. It has had an effect. And what's interesting to me is that a lot of the early adopters to the crypto story were the silver bugs. A lot of people that are in the silver market don't have as much risk aversion as gold people do, which means that they're willing to take more risk. So anecdotal evidence from more than one source, several people that were in silver that were disappointed with it going down or sideways took their, you know, monster boxes of silver, cashed it in and bought Bitcoin primarily and watched it take off. I think most of that change took place much earlier than what's happening recently with the city in the news. And that's a lot of the, let's say, wealthier class that's moving from gold into Bitcoin. This is it's typical of how these markets move. And that's my take. I think it's distracted a lot. I think, you know, this idea that Bitcoin is gold 2.0 really kind of is humorous to me. It's so much different than the gold market. And if I could just add one other thing that really hasn't been out in the consciousness of the investing public very much, is what I call hybrid, which is a cryptocurrency that's associated with the precious metals exactly. And this, I think, is the future that many people are not accounting for an increased demand over the next 5 years or so. If you could use your phone and transmit digital silver or gold in, let's say, 4 seconds flat and have something as stable as the precious metals are over a longer term, I think that whole system could catch on rapidly and probably pervasive throughout, let's say, the entire globe.
I was going to talk a little bit in general about your previous question, Jim, about cryptocurrencies and how that has maybe brought in new investors from different spaces. What we've seen is that young crypto investors are actually using some of the profits that they've made on cryptocurrencies to move and diversify into physical gold and silver. And in BullionStar, we've been offering the ability for customers to buy bullion using cryptocurrency since 2014, when we introduced Bitcoin as a transaction currency for buying bullion. And then subsequently, we introduced Ethereum and Litecoin and Bitcoin Cash in 2018. So I think that there are always going to be extremists in different markets, people that like gold, don't like silver, like bullion, but don't like crypto. And even to the extent of people who only like Bitcoin and won't hear anything about altcoins, they'll dismiss them. So I think that in general, the cryptocurrency revolution has been, in a way, good for introducing more people to bullion. And there are also a lot of the silver and gold bugs. Now, you see that, you can really feel it on Twitter that they're moving over into crypto, but they're not forgetting about bullion. They're trying to harness the features of both. I think that the vault bullion angle on crypto is interesting because if you take it back a step further to do with blockchain, in essence, Bitcoin was the first blockchain. And that created a whole new mathematical theory about how you can store holdings and have confidence that only one person at any time has those, and you can move those holdings and be confident that they've moved to the right place and all the records are on the ledger are up to date. So it is a fascinating ecological development that vault holdings can now be put on a blockchain and that companies can offer their customers in a way, an interface into their vault holdings, and knowing the customers can have confidence and knowing that those vault holdings are going to be there and that they can move them because of the fact that they're built on a blockchain. And everyone that's younger than ourselves for the last 10, 15 years understands that intuitively about blockchains. So they have a lot of confidence.
You know, as we take a look at what we're going on, and certainly as we take a look globally on the events that have unfolded over the last 12 months with the pandemic, the lockdowns, we're seeing money printing, we're seeing fiscal government spending like we have never seen, at least in my lifetime. They're talking about budget deficits this year that exceed $4 to $5 trillion, depending on how much money they're going to spend. We all know they haven't repealed the laws of economics. Sooner or later, there's going to come a day where this is going to have to play out. I mean, any government cannot print money and spend money and just print to pay for it. If that was the case, you know, places like Zimbabwe would be as prosperous as the U.S. So when that comes, and it's my belief that you're going to see a dollar devaluation, a major devaluation of all currencies. What happens as we're seeing right now, just in the pandemic, where people are scrambling, they're trying to get bullion. The bullion is going for a premium if you can get it. What happens when things really start to get chaotic in the markets and you're just not going to be able to get it?
Well, Jim, I tweeted out last night a couple of movie clips from the movie Rollover. And when I started on the speaking circuit about 20 years ago, I used to use a film clip of that movie to emphasize the point that we are possibly entering a situation like that. And I think we're getting closer to it. You've already answered your own question, and I know you know that, but you get into a panic, manic phase, where people will do almost anything to preserve their purchasing power. And whether or not we're going to, you know, to what level, what degree that happens remains to be determined. In fact, it could be off base. But when someone with the gravitas of Michael Burry, who was the person in the Big Short movie, recently put on his Twitter account that he's seen the adaption toward a hyperinflation taking place vis-a-vis what the Federal Reserve Board is doing, it does give you pause. I do and have done from basically inception when we met each other, Jim, saying that you need a hedge position. You don't need a philosophical bent that only the precious metals are real money and therefore that's the only place I invest. I want to stay balanced and sincere. On the other side of the coin, however, you do need a hedge position, and you really want one 6 months before the panic starts.
Dave, if people are having a hard time right now getting a hold of physical, I mean, I'm on a major website right now, and I don't care if I'm looking at Gold Eagles, Gold Buffaloes, Canadian Maple Leafs, Krugerrands, Silver Eagles, Silver Buffaloes, Platinum Coins, they're out of stock. So what does one do if you're trying to get it? Are you safe paying the kind of premiums that are being demanded right now?
Yeah, in Singapore, we're still able to get quite a wide variety of products delivered to us from our distributors because we have connections around Asia. But for example, like gold, Silver Eagles are out of stock. There's a very long lead time on that. I think there will come a time in the next few weeks where the availability will become even less in the States. I've been looking at all the U.S. and Canadian dealers. That started before it's hit Asia. And it is worrying that all of the dealers, when they get products, they're sold out instantly. And that seems to be a trend that will continue. But I think that securing bullion in the form of bars or coins right now, I wouldn't be worried about paying high premiums because I don't think it's going to get any better. Like, the premiums won't go down. They'll only go up. Because the availability blockage, so to speak, isn't going to be resolved anytime soon.
So when you're taking a look at these premiums right here, what would you suggest if, you know, you go to these websites and everything's out of stock? You just keep going back each day and hoping you get them at the right time when a shipment comes in?
Jim, a couple of things come to mind. One, if you're dealing with an established dealer you can trust, you might be able to take delayed delivery as long as you're willing to, you know, put up your fiat and wait 6-8 weeks. So that's one option that could be available from some of the larger dealers. The other part is, where do you go next? I mean, having lived through the 1970s and into the 1980 top, I know what happens, or at least what happened, and I would expect it to happen again. Anything gold and silver related starts to become a hot topic. So the mining shares get the idea that I can't get silver delivered. It's impossible, or I don't want to pay that kind of premium. Well, that will spill over into, where does it come from? Well, it comes from the silver mining community. So you will see people that will run into the mining community because that's the only place to secure some type of silver or gold exposure. And of course, as you well know, Jim, that's what happened in the 1930s when it was illegal for U.S. citizens to own physical gold. They moved into Homestake and Dome Mines primarily, and those two stocks went to the stratosphere in a few short years during the Great Depression. So that's what comes to my mind, Jim, is if you can't have the physical, which is the best, and I've always advocated that, the next best would be the top tier cash rich unhedged mining companies and anything below that in classification.
So if you can't get it, the next alternative would be to go who produces it. You know, an interesting story, and I'll just throw this out. I had a client that was relating a story to me. He was buying his silver directly from a silver company. They would have like silver rounds, silver bars. And he went to put in a large order because he saw silver taking off just like we do. We have taken a major position in the base metals plus silver. And he was saying that he could no longer buy from them. They took the selling off their site. And when he called them up to talk to him, he said, well, everything we have right now, we're being shipped to Wall Street. So it sounds to me like somebody's trying to cover a short position.
Well, it does. I mean, I don't want to get too excited. I think there's enough stress in the market just from what we can determine absolutely. But another anecdotal story, one of, let's say, the larger clients I have on the commercial side wanted to get shot. Silver shots pretty much used in the commercial area. And so I connected him with one of the wholesalers that I'm familiar with. And basically they said, it isn't that we don't have it. It's just that it's all accounted for. We're not taking any new buyers. Sorry. You know, and I think that's happening almost everywhere from what I've been able to determine. I mean, the physical supply is tight and getting tighter. And as the public smells this, they're going to basically get into that, I'll call it, I hate to use the word, but this panic or manic mode, which I, you know, think will happen at the top of the market. We're certainly not there yet. But I do think, as Ronan said, and I wouldn't have agreed with this in 2008 and 2009, but I am now. I think the premiums are here to stay. I could be wrong, but that's not the way the market looks, at least currently.
Well, certainly, I don't care what kind of coin you're looking for. There's a premium. And even if you pay the premium, the real question is, can you still get the stuff? So I guess as we kind of summarize and close here, what would you recommend to individuals right now, both Ronan and Dave, to comment on this, when you can't get the metals right now? I mean, try to get a Gold Eagle, Gold Buffalo, Maple Leaf, good luck. And I don't care if it's gold or silver. What would you be telling people to do?
Well, Jim, you know, I'm not a dealer, so I'm biased because the main focus of the Morgan Report has been riches and resources through the equity markets. And that's what I specialize in. It's not just silver, but now it's been focused on gold and silver over the last couple of years, because that's what the market has been telling us. We like copper. We just wrote up a 3 copper situations a couple months ago, and copper's going straight up, as you well know. So I think that's the best exposure. And I just want to warn people that, you know, buying cheap stocks is not the best way to go from my very experienced point of view. You want to start with the stalwarts. You want the main household names, the blue chips. And once you have a solid base in that part of the market, then you can branch out and speculate and that type of thing.
I would say that to answer your question, and also to comment on your previous question about pricing and the fact that you've got the Wall Street spot price and then you've got premiums, people should really sit back and think about the pricing of physical versus the pricing of paper and not really look at it as a premium to the spot price. We are starting to think in Bullion Star that the spot price that comes from Wall Street in London is not really relevant at all, and that we might start pricing on a fixed price basis based on the equilibrium price that reflects supply and demand. And that really evolves into that people shouldn't be thinking about what the price in dollar terms is of gold and silver, but about how much physical ounces of gold and silver they can accumulate. Because after all, gold and silver are real ultimate forms of money, and they have been for thousands of years. So people shouldn't really be fixated about what the premium is to a spot price that is derived on a paper market, but about how much physical they can accumulate. I think that there is still gold and silver available, investment gold and silver, but you will have to look more widely to find it. And for example, like we source from Hong Kong and Turkey, not just from the States. So that outside the US and Canada, there is still metal flowing into different places like Hong Kong and Asia.
Well, it's absolutely amazing. I would say this, there's going to come a point in the future where you're just not going to be able to get it at all, never mind what premiums that are out there right now. And given the fact that you may not be able to get it in the future, do you ever see a point, Dave or Ronan, where the physical market actually drives the price versus the paper market, which has driven it for decades?
Well, I've said it for years, Jim, and my belief system is that, as I said earlier in the interview, that there comes a time very rarely in monetary history where there's a disconnect between the trust and confidence factor that governments pretend to be all-knowing, omniscient, all-seeing, and, you know, rule over us with their monetary masters. And enough the public wakes up and says, the emperor has no clothes. I can bite this. I trust it. This has been money for thousands of years, and that's what I need to have. And I think we've hit that. I don't know. I don't want to get too excited, but all indications are something happened, as Ronan explained, early on, just a few weeks ago, where we had this huge inflow into the ETPs. And it looks as if that stress may have caused something that will come to fruition as time marches forward.
Ronan, if our listeners would like to contact you regarding the purchase of bullion, how could they do so?
Well, we have a shop and showroom in Singapore. It's actually expanded recently. It's very large and very impressive. But if you are outside Singapore, you can log on to our transactional website, www.bullions.bullionstar.com, and you can buy and sell precious metals, silver, gold, platinum, numismatics, even bullion jewelry. We have a very large product range still. And if anyone wants to follow Bullion Star on Twitter, it's at Bullion Star. It's quite easy to find. And if anyone wanted to even email me, my email is ronan.manley@bullionstar.com, M-A-N-L-Y.
Best thing is go to our main webpage, themorganreport.com, and get on our free newsletter service. If you're interested in the subscription service, just pull down the subscribe menu and you can have a look.
That concludes my interview with Dave Morgan and Ronan Manley from Bullion Star. I wanted to cover this topic because, as you saw a couple of weeks ago with GameStop, the next one that they were supposedly the traders were going after was a silver short position. That lasted about a single day before authorities moved in and put a stop to it. But here's the point I want to make. Right now, if you want bullion, you're going to have to pay a premium. But here's the thing. Even if you have to pay a premium, you can still get it. That may not be the case. And one of the things that really struck me, especially when it comes to silver, silver is an industrial metal as well as being a precious metal. And all the electronic devices you think about, your iPads, your iPhones, all the electronic devices that we have today, and also the way silver is being used as a biocide and also in green energy with solar panels, wait till you see the commercial companies like an Apple or somebody else figure out that there's going to be a shortage of silver, and you get the industrial companies that actually use silver in manufacturing start stepping in the market and buying and taking delivery off the COMEX. Man, will you see sparks fly. Point I'm making is you should always have some physical bullion, gold, silver, whatever your preference is, and have that as a hedge against everything else. And what I would say, given what I'm seeing unfold here, it may not be too far down the road where you just simply won't be able to get it because the demand will be so great. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years, feel free to give us a call at 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management Team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.